and they all turned their attention back to the old man sleeping in the chair. I follow Mr. Gideon down another hallway for quite some time, the sound of our breathing loud in the enclosed space. This hallway is lit by electric lights, and I take the time to watch Mr. Gideon. He walks stiffly, but his limp is gone. What happened to your limp? Was it an affectation or the real thing? Mr. Gideon laughs. You don't mince words much, do you? I find that my lot in life has less to do with what I say than who I am, I answer. He nods and looses a long sigh.
I can see how that would be true. Well, I have a mechanical brace for my leg. It helps me walk, but it's tiresome. So I don't wear it all of the time. Plus, the limp makes the sheriff think I'm weak. And to speak truthfully, I prefer him underestimating me.
You don't like him much either, huh?
The man is a monster, and that apple didn't tumble far from the tree.
I'm surprised by the vehemence in his voice. We fall silent after that. The hallway eventually ends, and I'm surprised to find us back in Mr. Gideon's lab. These tunnels are one giant rabbit warren, I murmur.
Yes, they are. I use that tunnel to get back and forth from town. It's actually a more direct route than the road. It also helps me hide my movements from the sheriff.
There's a metal gate separating the hallway from the lab, and Mr. Gideon unlocks it with a key around his neck. He holds the gate open until I pass through, and then secures it behind me. It's the gentlemanly thing to do, and I suddenly feel very nervous being alone with him. It ain't just that it's improper, which it is, but the last time I was alone with a boy was Jackson, back in the day. And despite my fearsome predicament, a wave of loneliness overwhelms me. I miss my mama, and Auntie Aggie, and Big Sue back in Baltimore. I miss Jackson and his stupid plans, and little Ruthie and her nothing-but-fluff braids. I miss Miss Duncan and her make-your-arms-mush scythe drills. I even miss Catherine, which I never thought I'd be saying. Mostly, I miss being hopeful. There ain't a lick of hope in Summerland, from what I can see, despite the advertising. And the drudgery of it all is enough to make a girl just lay down and die. I collapse on a long bench before a table a good distance away from the lab equipment. Mr. Gideon goes to a cabinet and removes a jar, returning to the table and sitting on the matching bench on the other side.
Here, I'm afraid I don't have a fork. But at least they're tasty. My mother sends them along, since we haven't gotten around to planting trees yet out here.
Mr. Gideon slides a jar of peaches across the table at me, and I pick up the ball jar and twist off the two-piece lid. The scent of the peaches hits me, and I dig in with my fingers, pulling out a peach slice and shoving it in my mouth. It's sweet and juicy, and I've eaten half the jar before I remember my manners enough to offer Mr. Gideon some. He waves me away with a smile.
I'm good, thank you. Our rations haven't been cut like yours have.
I think about Ida, back up in the bedroom, and I refasten the lid, saving the other half of the jar for her. She's been kinder to me than anyone else here, mostly keeping me out of trouble, and it's the least I can do for her. So, I say, once I've wiped my fingers on the front of my raggedy shirt, tell me about them shamblers you're keeping in that cage. Mr. Gideon sighs heavily and sits down.
Well, first of all, this wasn't of my making. I had an idea, and the result is a gross perversion of it.
So what was your idea, then?
Technology, innovation, a modernized state in which all Americans, Negroes, whites, Indians, could live together.
He jumps to his feet and begins pacing.
Summerland was supposed to be a shining beacon of hope, a noble egalitarian vision for the future, a place to carve out a new idea of what our country could become, risen from the ashes of oppression and death.
He waves his hands around before running them through his hair, and there's something about watching a man talk with that much passion that makes me sit up and take notice.
Electricity was at the heart of my vision, he continued. It would keep the town safe and perform labor. Electrified fences, electrical appliances to wash clothing, to cook food. The war ended slavery. Electricity could lay the foundation for an automated settlement where we could continue the march toward a fair and equal society. I worked for a time with Mr. Edison in his compound in Menlo Park. When I returned home to Baltimore, I told my father about my ideas, and he got the notion of me going west to improve some of the frontier towns. He convinced me to discuss the plan with a small group of his political allies. I needed financing, and it was my hope that they might see the potential in the idea. They did, and my father took steps to put it in action. But when I arrived here, it was nothing like what I had laid out.
He finally stopped pacing and sat down.
My idea was to locate a town near a natural resource to run the generators, a river, a stream, coal veins. This area has no viable power source. But they had already established the foundations of the settlement, with dozens of people living here.
I think back to the night of Mayor Carr's dinner party, the electric lights on his house, the newspaper man who was mysteriously bitten. Hence that contraption I just saw back there. Mr. Gideon sits next to me on the bench and pulls a piece of paper and some charcoal toward him. He sketches out a drawing.
It's a simple Faraday machine. The wheel turns, making the magnets shift, and causes power to flow down the wires. In an effort to keep the town from collapsing, I retrofit the generator to run on physical labor. The undead never tire. They don't need much in the way of sustenance to maintain locomotion. They need only be replaced every once in a while.
He grimaces as I give him a look.
I'll admit it's not one of my best ideas. It runs the lights, and that's about all, to be honest. The idea was to have the electricity power a barrier fence, much more deadly and effective than barbed wire or even the brick wall. Something that would last much longer and keep undead out of a large area. But the single generator could never power a viable perimeter fence, even if we had the manpower to finish building one. So, there are electric lights and a wall to keep the deathless out. The town looks pretty, but in the meantime, we have the same society we did back east. One that subjugates and kills more than half its population to guard the smaller portion. What is the point of that? How is this progress?
I know why the tinkerer is frustrated, but I don't have an answer to his question and just shake my head.
He continues. So, here we are. The undead are generating the electricity in the town, such as it is. We might be able to create more power if we could build more generators and improve the electrical infrastructure. But the Negroes and Roughnecks have their hands full maintaining the barrier, and the Snyders refuse to make the whites within town work on the fence. They just waste their time having tea and drinking.
I frown. Mr. Gideon, I beg your pardon, but this all makes absolutely no sense. Shamblers? Here, within the walls? He leans forward, a shine in his eyes that I'm pretty sure ain't entirely from the electric lights.
With my help, they've turned this place into a survivalist nightmare. They believe the undead, like the Negro, were put here to serve whites,
and that it's our place to guide, but not to labor. Meanwhile, the survivalist drovers and laborers are tired of being forced to tend to fields. They believe it should be their turn to enjoy the good life. But the interior fence isn't even finished, and it's only the patrols that are keeping us from being overrun. And all the people over there in the town, the fancy ones, they're survivalists too? Mr. Gideon leans back suddenly, his expression shuddering. Not all of them. But that's all I'm going to say about that, Miss McKean. The hour is getting late, and while I worry for the future of Summerland, it isn't going to fall tomorrow. You should get back to your bed before the sheriff and his boys finish sleeping off last night's revelry. I climb to my feet, clutching the jar of peaches. Thank you for the food.
Don't mention it. The town is headed for a reckoning, and I have a feeling things are going to get worse before they get better.
I hesitate a moment before I reach into my waistband. Tom Sawyer was the last gift Jackson ever gave me, and I haven't finished the book just yet. But I hate owing anyone a debt. And who knows, maybe if everything works out, I can find myself another copy. Here, for the peaches. Mr. Gideon takes the book uncertainly, turning it over in his hands.
I thank you.
Sweet dreams, Mr. Gideon, I say over my shoulder as I climb the stairs.
Sweet dreams, Jane,
he says, his voice far away. I let myself out of the lab and slip past the outhouses and the abandoned hotel. The sun is just starting to hint at its rise over the horizon to the east, but it's still mostly dark. And I'm almost to the saloon when I hear the unmistakable sound of a gun cocking.
Well, hello there, Jane,
Sheriff Snyder drawls. He stands just a few feet behind me, grinning, and I'm once again reminded of the stories I've heard of alligators.
I do believe you are breaking curfew.
I open my mouth to come up with some story to excuse myself, but the sheriff has a hell of a left hook, and I go down before I can utter a word. It's sad news that our neighbor to the east, Mr. Barringer, has been overrun. We've taken in 20 of the Negroes who lived on his land and a nasty old overseer named Duncan. I have a feeling that Duncan is not going to last here in Rose Hill. I must say that it is curious that so many of these men who subscribed wholeheartedly to the peculiar institution are turning shambler. Chapter 27, in which I have had enough. When I come to, Sheriff Snyder and Bill have me by either arm and are dragging me through the dirt of the street. I try fighting, but that punch from the sheriff has me seeing stars, and I'm no match for two grown men. I'm tied to the whipping post in front of the sheriff's office. I try to climb to my feet, struggling against the ropes, alarm and a powerful headache both clanging in my head. But there's no getting free. I'm dizzy. But whether it's from taking a hit or the combination of exhaustion and hunger, there's no telling. But I fully recognize that I am not in a very good place. Next to me comes a low chuckle. Bill is leaning against the pole, whittling and whistling, looking like he ain't got a care in the world.
You think you're smart, don't you? Told you were going to learn some manners here. And it looks like the sheriff is just about ready to dispatch that lesson. Bill,
the voice behind me is raspy.
Go round up the flock. They've slept enough. And this sermon requires sinners. Yes, sir, Bill says.
He moves off and the preacher shuffles nearer.
Now, I know what you're thinking, Jane. You're scared, and that's natural. You're wondering how you ended up here. If there wasn't some kind of thing you could have done differently to avoid this whole mess.
My heart pounds, loud enough that I'm sure he can hear it. I can't see him, so when his breath tickles my ear, the scent of him filling my nose, I flinch.
The reality is that you couldn't do anything. This is all as God wills it to be. In the wake of the punishment laid down by the Lord are his laws laid bare. All his creations are not equal, but we are all his children, all with our place. The rapture, such as it is here on earth. The white man ascends. His dark counterparts are his servants, laying the stones in the pathway to heaven. That we ever thought otherwise, that we once entertained the notion of equality for all of God's children on earth, that we fought and killed one another over it, well, we know how that turned out.
He rests a hand on my shoulder, patting it affectionately, and his touch nauseates me.
This punishment will be brutal, my dear, but your mortal flesh will bear it, because it must. Take comfort that in reaffirming his order, we give him thanks.
He backs away and coughs, the sound wet and phlegmy.
Trust in the Lord, and he will guide you through this hardship.
From behind me comes the sound of footsteps and murmurs. I try to twist and see who it is, but I cannot turn that far around. Under my shirt, my penny has gone to ice.
Oh, don't worry, girlie. You're going to have quite the audience,
Bill says, back from rousing the patrols.
The sheriff is a fair man, but he knows an instigator when he sees one. No different than dogs, really. And every now and then, you just get a bad dog. Maybe it's poor breeding. Maybe it's poor training. Only thing you can do is punish him and hope he learns who his master is. And if not, well, sometimes you just gotta put a bad dog down.
His footsteps echo on the wooden boards of the walkway as they move away from me. And I test my bonds to see if there's any way to wriggle free. Panic digs its broken fingernails into my soul. I remember the day I had asked Auntie Aggie what it was like back before the shamblers walked, back before the war. It was bad then, Janie. A different kind of bad, but bad all the same. I once saw a man whipped to death for stealing a loaf of bread from the mistress's kitchen. Not your mama, mind you, but the missus that came before her. Overseer took the skin clean off of him, till there wasn't nothing but meat left. So don't let nobody tell you any different about the old days. Life is hard now. Nothing but suffering. But some kinds of suffering is easier to bear than others. I'd never asked her again about the bad old days. But now, with my hand secured to the whipping post, I wish I had. Behind me, the sounds of footfalls and murmuring rises, and this time when I crane my neck around, I get a glimpse of the crowd, gathering in the first bit of sunlight. Right now, it's mostly Negroes, a few drovers mixed in here and there. I don't recognize many of the faces, and I figure it must be the night crews. I stop straining against the bonds securing my hands, since there ain't no use to it, and all I'm doing is giving myself a fine rope burn. After what feels like hours, but is actually only a few minutes, someone exclaims,
"Jane! What are you doing?"
I twist as far as I can. Behind me, Ida stares with wide eyes.
"I told you not to get caught!"
Her voice carries all the fear and panic eating at my middle, and I squeeze my eyes shut like I can somehow hide from what comes next. But I can't.
I've never been scared of death. Everyone dies. And I don't like wasting energy fretting about certitudes. But Aunt Aggie's words keep echoing through my brain. Whipped to death. Took the skin clean off. The fear is so powerful that I can't do anything but stare straight ahead. Gaze locked on the wooden post in front of me. Behind me, someone clears his throat.
Listen up, y'all. The sheriff has a few words to say.
Boots echo on the boardwalk in front of me, stopping just a little off to the side. I look up, and the sheriff squints down at me. His expression is blank, but there's a glint of something in his eye. Satisfaction? I turn my gaze back to the wood post in front of me.
Summerland is a place of laws and order, and I am the long arm of that law. Our goal here is not the glorification of the individual, but to create a harmonious community that can serve as a model to the chaos of those cities in the East. Just as the Israelites left Egypt for the promise of a better life, so have all of you. But for that harmony to be achieved, each of us must know his place. You don't let a dog pretend to be a horse, and the same it must be with our dark cousins. There is a natural order to things, as the pastor tells us. And when that order is not obeyed, disaster rides hard on its heels.
There's no comment from the crowd. No murmur of dissent, no valiant objections on my behalf. The only sound is of someone coughing far off. I know that if I'm going to say anything, this might be my last chance. People deserve to know about the danger festering underground.
You have to listen to me. Back in town, these men have built
a crack. Comes across my jaw, hard enough to shake my brain something terrible, and Bill steps back, shaking his hand and cursing. Blood fills my mouth and I fall silent. It's no use. The sheriff continues.
This darkie broke curfew. That transgression calls for a minimum of 20 lashes. It gives me no pleasure to hand down this punishment. But hand it down, I will.
I half expect him to start praying, but thankfully I am spared that blasphemy. Someone, likely Bill again, steps close to me, and I jerk in surprise as the back of my shirt is grabbed. There's a tearing sound, and then a gasp as my garment is torn in half. I roll my shoulders forward, suddenly modest. The air is warm on my bare back, and my breath comes in short pants, my embarrassment almost overriding my fear.
What's this?
Bill asks, leaning close. He reaches down the front of my shirt, and I jerk away from him, fearful that he's reaching for my bosoms. Instead, his hand comes up with my penny. He yanks the cord hard enough to break the leather thong.
Don't think you'll be needing this, he says,
his breath hot and rank on my cheek. The sheriff steps down from the boardwalk into the hard-packed dirt of the street, standing behind me. I can almost see him slowly uncoiling the whip at his side, relishing the drama and anxiety of the crowd.
Bill, would you be so kind as to keep the count?
Of course, Sheriff.
The satisfaction in his voice makes me long to put a bullet in him. The whip whistles through the air before it carves agony across my back. I inhale sharply and arch away from the pain, my chest slamming into the post.
One!
The second lash comes too quickly, stealing my air and making my muscles tighten.
Two!
The whip comes round again,
and I'm trying to think of something else, trying to be anywhere else. But I am bound to my cursed flesh, and tears make their way down my cheeks as the whip tears into my back again, and again, and again.
3, 4, 5, 5.
My heart nearly stutters to a stop when Bill counts 5 twice in a row. My back is a fiery mess of agony, and when the whip comes across again, a sob tears out of me.
6.
I'm shaking from the pain, delirious with it. With each crack of the whip, I make a new promise to the Lord Almighty. I will never lie again if this stops.
Crack!
I will dedicate my life to your good works.
Crack!
Either the good Lord is unimpressed with my offerings, or he thinks I deserve this, just as the preacher told me. Bill has just counted off the 11th lash when the crowd behind me begins murmuring. I can't think, the pain robbing me of whatever wit I possess. I'm crying and muttering, half mad with the pain. 9 more lashes, and that's if Bill keeps the count correctly. Somehow I know he won't. He's enjoying this as much as the sheriff.
Stop! Please, stop!
Catherine's voice is unmistakable, and at first I think my ears are deceiving me. But the sheriff pauses and says,
Miss Devereaux, this is no place for you. You should go back to your home. What brings you here?
I did, comes another voice.
You're killing her attendant, and she has a right to know that since the girl has been in her employ. Gideon, you are not the law in this town.
There's a tightness to the sheriff's voice, but I'm too relieved that the whip has ceased its torment for the moment to analyze why he would even listen to Mr. Gideon in the first place.
Sheriff, it is said that the man who exercises compassion is the wisest of all. I'm urging you to be a wise man. It's obvious that the girl won't survive much more. And neither will this town. You've done enough. Gideon!
Please, Sheriff,
Catherine pleads, a tremor in her voice.
Jane is a bit headstrong, but she is also an excellent companion. I've become fond of her, and I would be heartbroken if she were to come to any more harm. Please let her go. Show her mercy.
Behind me, the sheriff sighs.
Miss Devereaux, you are a kind girl, but law and order must be upheld.
And if a man smite his servant or his maid with a rod, and he die under his hand, he shall be surely punished. That's Exodus chapter 21, verse 20. I'm certain this isn't what the good pastor meant to happen. There's no doubt that Jane broke the rules, as she is known to do from time to time. But she is suffering greatly, and as she's my servant, my soul would bear the burden of her misfortune. Please, Sheriff, Catherine says, her voice choked with emotion. I know without even looking at her that her face is probably streaked with tears, her light eyes too bright. Have mercy!
There's a pause, and the sound of my labored breath fills my ears, heartbeat keeping time to the seconds ticking by. After too long, the sheriff says,
You are right, of course. Compassion is critical in a leader.
Yes, Sheriff. No one doubts your word is law.
My hands are suddenly released, and when I try to stand, I stumble. Catherine is there to help me, and when she turns me around, 2 things strike me at once. The first is the sadness and anger
warring on Mr. Gideon's face as he watches me. His jaw is tight and his fists are clenched. Whether these emotions are about me being whipped or because he just don't like the sheriff, I don't know. The second thing that strikes me is the way the sheriff is looking in my direction. It's a soft kind of look, the way one would watch a baby or a bunny, full of wonder and interest. At first, I can't figure why the man would look at me in such an indulgent way. But then I realize that he ain't looking at me. He's looking at Catherine. And just like that, the plan I've been struggling to come up with for weeks explodes in my brain like a stick of dynamite with a too short fuse. Catherine half carries, half drags me past the assembled crowd. I lift my head just long enough to see Cora give me a smug look, and I know at that moment she's the reason the sheriff caught me in the first place. The Duchess comes over, worry on her face. You bring her to my room. I'll help you get her cleaned up. Jane doesn't belong in a whorehouse, Catherine says, as mutton-headed as ever. Her bosoms are hanging out for the world to see, and she won't make it to the proper side of town, the Duchess snaps back.
She's right, Mr. Gideon says. I'll bring by some salve. Let the Duchess take her. You're going to have to contend with Pastor Snyder.
Catherine sighs. Fine. Take good care of her. I'll be by later. Then it's just me and the Duchess and the endless walk to the whorehouse. Every moment sends agony singing across my back. My skin is hot and aching, and I fight to keep from sobbing. I ain't successful, though. We enter the house of ill repute, heading straight for the Duchess's room, which is on the first floor. She helps me sit on the edge of the bed, and I lean forward, resting my elbows on my knees, and groan. Until Mr. Gideon comes by with his concoction, there ain't much I can do for you. She trails off. Thank you. There's no need for thanks. This is wrong. Everything about this place is wrong. A slight brogue has appeared in the Duchess's voice, and when I glance up at her, tears stream freely down her cheeks. Are you okay? I ask. A bark of laughter escapes from her. Here you are, flayed within an inch of your life, and you're asking after me. I sigh. Sometimes it's easier to think about other folks' small hurts than your big ones. She sits next to me on the bed, sniffling. I was married before I came here. Leopold. He was the most beautiful man I'd ever seen. Skin like it had been kissed by the night. We thought we'd be safe if we could just get far enough away. Her gaze goes distant, her face twisted with the memory of some distant horror. You can never get far enough away from people like the preacher. I half laugh. I suppose so. And the sheriff. The two of them are peas in a pod, but the sheriff is only following his daddy's lead. He's mean, but he isn't smart enough to run this town on his own. The uneven sound of boots on the wooden floor makes me raise my head, and Mr. Gideon stands in the doorway with a small pot of something and his eyes averted in deference to my modesty. Not that it much matters now. I reckon nearly all of Summerland had a chance to spy my bosoms, had they cared to. I shall take care of this, the Duchess says, rising and plucking the jar of salve out of Mr. Gideon's hand. Behind him stands Nessie, the colored girl who braided my hair, with a steaming bowl of water and a cloth.
Thought you might need this, she says in a low voice. She sets the water on a nearby table. The small kindness warms. Thank you, I say. Could I trouble you for a glass of water?
Of course, Nessie says, before disappearing from the room, Mr. Gideon stepping aside to let her go.
He clears his throat. Jane, the sheriff has agreed to allow you a day of rest from your patrol. Catherine has asked him to give you back over to her supervision, but I'm not sure she'll get her wish. It's doubtful the preacher will allow it. He hovers in the doorway uncertainly, and a glance at his face reveals a worried expression.
What's wrong, Tinkerer? I ask, my voice rough from the pain of my back.
This isn't right, he says, as though he ain't quite sure what else to say. The Duchess pushes the edges of my shirt aside and begins to clean my wounds. I can't help but cry out in pain, eyes watering from the agony.
No, this ain't right, the Duchess finally says after a few heartbeats.
I'm too befuddled from the whipping to think proper, my entire existence narrowing to the screaming of my back.
The question, Professor, is what exactly you plan to do about it.
From the doorway comes a heavy sigh. I told you that patience is required for things like this.
I'm running out of patience, Gideon. So is most everyone else. We're starving. The Negroes are ill-treated. And there are undead within the boundaries. I know that pretty little lass of yours has been working on the men. But even a face as pretty as hers isn't going to end all this suffering.
I know this, Maeve. What can I do about it? What is there to do? What can be done that we haven't tried before?
The preacher is an unassailable mountain, I mutter. He relies on the sheriff to enforce his will. We need to get someone on our side in with him, someone who can control him, someone who can help put the sheriff in a compromising position, one that he doesn't anticipate, so we can use that opportunity to take him down.
The Duchess pauses in her ministrations.
We've tried that before. He beat the poor girl something fierce, nearly killed her, she says,
low enough that the tinkerer doesn't hear.
Not sex. Love. I say, panting as the Duchess goes back to cleaning my wounds.
The sheriff is not a man laid low by something as banal as carnal pleasures.
But the sheriff is a man who knew love once, who fell for a good woman. That hole in his heart is the doorway to our freedom.
So what exactly are you saying? Mr. Gideon removes his glasses and wipes them clean.
You heard the sheriff out there with that nonsense about the Israelites? He really did come here for a better life, just like everyone else who got on a train by choice. The promise of something more. And what did he get in return? To watch the woman he loved get eaten.
If we want to take down the sheriff, we need to dangle bait that he cannot resist. A woman who can give what he once had with his wife and who can help him elevate his social status. A girl of good breeding. That's what the sheriff will fall for. He's a man that pretends to greatness and at the same time aches for love. He would crumple under the attention of a true lady. And once he does, we get rid of him.
You're talking about murder, the Duchess asks.
It ain't murder if a man gets turned.
She snorts, dropping the rag into the bowl of water with a wet plop.
And I suppose you plan on dangling your companion on that hook.
I saw how he was looking at her. He's already half in love, I say.
It's not a bad idea, Mr. Gideon says. I look up just long enough to take in his expression, his eyes sparking with intelligence, his lips pursed in thought. My heart flops like a trout on a riverbank.
Here's the thing about me. I have always been a complete and utter muttonhead for a clever boy, even when I'm half delirious with pain.
Yes, I say, closing my eyes and sucking in a sharp breath as the Duchess uses a light touch to spread the salve over my back. Just imagine if the sheriff knew all about Miss Devereaux's tragic past.
What tragic past? Mr. Gideon asks.
I swallow dryly, and Nessie appears just then. She hands me the glass of water and I drink it down before I tell my tale. I'm counting on knowing Catherine. If I'm right, she hasn't told anyone about where she came from, but rather distracted them with small talk. It's been her modus operandi since I met her, and old habits die hard.
Did you know she is actually one of the Chesters of Chester County, Virginia? She ended up in Baltimore nearly destitute because her stepmother is a dastardly woman. The lie darn near spins itself. Her father passed quite unexpectedly, and Miss Devereaux's stepmother sent her up north to live with cousins. Only her cousins were quite savagely attacked and murdered by the undead. Family by the name of Edgar, the mayor of Baltimore took pity on her and invited her to stay in his own house until she could contact her relatives. But, well, old Blunderbuss took a shine to her, and the missus wasn't about to have that. So here she is, the proverbial Moses in the basket. The burning in my back settles into a steady throb. The salve the tinkerer brought actually helping. A strange look has come over Gideon's face, and his lips twitch as though he's fighting back a smile.
That is quite a tale, Miss McKean, he says.
What no tale? It's the God's honest truth. Miss Devereaux is as tragic as poor Ophelia.
Ophelia? He asks.
Yes. From Hamlet. Ain't you never read Shakespeare?
Oh, I have. I'm just surprised you have.
You shouldn't jump to conclusions about people, Mr. Gideon. I contain multitudes. Nessie slips out of the room as quietly as she appeared, and from the look on her face, I know that the story of Catherine Devereaux will be on every drover's lips by nightfall. The Duchess stands and shoos Gideon away.
You need to get going, so I can help Miss McKean get presentable.
There's a discreet cough from next to the door.
Of course, of course. Well, thank you for the information, Miss McKean. I'm willing to bet that the sheriff would be horrified to discover how shoddily the world has treated a lady of Miss Devereaux's caliber. He'll want to see to her comfort personally, I'd wager.
Gideon's uneven gait echoes down the hall, and after the door closes, the Duchess stands over me.
Remind me never to play poker with you.
I allow myself a small smile before standing. The Duchess helps me to pull on a clean shirt. I ain't sure that I can trust her, but there ain't been much kindness since I got to Summerland, and I've yet to see the Duchess on the dispensing end of any cruelty.
Why you helping me anyway?
It can't just be because of your long-lost love. The small smile she wears is wiped from her face.
Let's just say,
that I got some stains on my soul that I wouldn't mind getting scrubbed clean.
And you think helping a Negro girl is going to do that?
I think being the kindest person I have the wherewithal to be is going to do that.
I nod and think of Lily. I hope she's safe this morning.
Think you can get your hands on some laudanum?
The Duchess smirks.
Do shamblers have yellow eyes?
We're going to need some. The stronger the better. And a bottle of wine. The finest available in this place.
How soon? She asks, as I finish getting dressed.
I lie face down on her bed, pillowing my head on my arms, completely drained in the aftermath of a hellish morning. If everything goes as planned, soon. But let's aim for the end of the month. 2 weeks, I say, before finally giving in to my exhaustion.
Jane, please write back as soon as possible. I ache to hear about the escapades you were having in Maryland. Is it as refined as all of the papers would have us believe?
Chapter 28, in which I beg for forgiveness. I wake to Catherine yelling,
Jane McKean, did you tell Mr. Gideon that I have been sent here because of a man's jealous wife?
Shh. There's no need to yell, I groan, and attempt to get up, forgetting the trauma to my back until agony explodes across my skin. Firm hands push me back down.
Just lie there. There's no need to move right now, Catherine says, her words gentle but her tone still sharp.
I settle back onto my stomach and Catherine climbs onto the bed next to me. She smells of lavender water, and it reminds me of my mother so much that I nearly hug her.
Jane,
Catherine says after a moment. She measures her words, trying not to lose her temper with me.
Why did you tell Mr. Gideon my secret, after I expressly forbade you to tell anyone?
Her words are still too loud, and I worry that someone might overhear. I open my mouth to explain and then pause.
What?
Catherine leans in close.
Jane McKean, we have been acquainted long enough for me to know one of your plots when it comes knocking. There are about 4 of the Duchess's girls pressed up against the door right now, listening in. Even now, they're memorizing all this to tell their customers later tonight. And no one gossips like men.
I grit my teeth. You're a lady, Miss Catherine. You shouldn't even be here, I say, loud enough to be heard.
Feh. The sheriff is out of town on some business, and the preacher is giving his nightly sermon to the sinners of Summerland.
Her lips twist when she mentions Pastor Snyder, and she lowers her voice.
Anyway, I figured sneaking in here was worth the risk. What's your plan?
What makes you think I have a plan? I ask. She gives me a bit of side eye, and I sigh. I shift and sit up, even though it hurts something fierce. I don't know what's beyond the walls of Summerland, but it can't be worse than what's inside them. If we're going to get out of here, we need to get rid of the sheriff. He has eyes everywhere, and not just his men, but folks on the patrol like Cora, too. And who knows who else? There's no way we're getting free while he's in charge. Which means we have to get close to him, compromise him, and he's much too careful for anyone else to do it, so it's up to you. We need him to fall in love with you.
Absolutely not. I will not compromise myself for that man.
Under the indignant anger,
I can tell Catherine is close to tears. These last few weeks must have been just as hard on her as they were on me. It's clear from her voice what she thought I was asking of her, and I swallow hard. Catherine ain't got no reason to believe that I wouldn't ask such a thing of her, and it makes me feel ugly to know that she thinks I would. I haven't always been the best to Catherine, and being trapped in this awful place reminds me of that. I reach out and take her hand, squeezing it.
I ain't asking you to give yourself to him, Kate. I might be coarse, but I ain't a monster.
Catherine says nothing for a long time, and when she finally does speak, her words are choked with emotion.
Good. Because I won't barter my body for your freedom, Jane, nor mine.
No, and you won't have to. You just need to get close to him, drug him, and leave the rest to me. Then we'll liberate ourselves and hightail it out of here.
What about everyone else?
What about them?
We cannot just hightail it out of here and leave everyone to that man's non-existent mercy, Jane.
Catherine is whispering much too loud, and I shush her. This is most definitely not part of her act. I could tell her there won't be a sheriff left when I'm done, but I doubt she'd go along with the plan if she thought it was predicated on unsavory business.
Keep your voice down. Like you said, walls have ears and all.
I already figured we'd take whoever wanted to go with us. That's the best I can offer.
That's not good enough, Catherine says, her voice low. What about Lily and the Spencers? What about Jackson?
Jackson is dead, I say, my voice flat. Catherine jerks as though she's been slapped.
Well, when were you going to share that little revelation?
Her voice is hollow, and I hate her for feeling anything for Jackson at all. Even with him gone, I still think of him as mine. What a stupid, selfish girl I am. I just didn't think to share it. I'm sorry. I know you fancied him.
I did not fancy him, she says. I don't fancy anyone, but he was a good person, and his passing is unfortunate.
In the future, you need to tell me these things instead of suffering the truth in silence. Catherine's tone is haughty, even as she whispers,
and if I'm meant to get close to the sheriff and get his guard down, I ain't doing it alone.
She jumps off the bed, and I notice she's wearing a lovely blue silk day dress, akin to what the ladies of Baltimore used to wear.
I appreciate your dedication, Jane, but I'll not have you injured so badly again, she says, loud enough for anyone to hear.
Her tone is polished, befitting a lady of her supposed station.
As soon as you've mended enough to be useful, you will return to your attendance duties. Understood?
Of course, Miss Catherine, I say, slipping into the characteristic speech patterns of an uneducated serving girl.
I'll try to get better lickety-split. Don't you worry none about me. I'm a real fast healer.
Catherine shoots me one of her too familiar dirty looks, an expression I haven't seen in a while, and I smile as she slips out the door. I feel better than I have in weeks, even with my mangled back. I'm confident that I will be en route to Rose Hill and my mama soon. If it means playing lady's maid to Catherine in the meantime, so be it. How bad can it be?
Auntie Aggie sends her love, by the way. She wants me to remind you to keep out of trouble and to always wear your lucky penny. She also wants me to tell you that the beets just haven't grown right since you left. It seems even the garden misses your presence.
Chapter 29, in which I struggle to keep from committing homicide. I discover even before joining Catherine in the rich end of town that she has taken to her role of displaced lady like a duck to water. A very arrogant, snobbish duck. After a week of rest, I'm mostly healed up. The cuts and raw spots have crusted over enough that I can mostly move around. And even though my back twinges when I move too quickly, it's nothing I can't ignore. When the Duchess brings me clothes to put on, they are nothing like the trousers and rough spun shirt I was given before. I stare at the lovely calico dress in awe, fingers grazing the fine blue-patterned weave. Blue is my second favorite color, and I'm almost afraid to contemplate that the lovely dress might actually be for me. "What's going on?" I ask. "Since the story of Miss Devereaux's dire straits have made the rounds, Sheriff Snyder has been bending over backward to see to her comfort. Catherine asks that you be given a new dress, since it is unseemly that her attendant should be seen in the garb of a field hand." The Duchess says this last bit in Catherine's accent, and I snort to keep from laughing out loud. "Yes, that sounds like my Miss Catherine, all right," I say, going along with the act just in case anyone might be listening. For the sheriff to believe that Catherine is a lady, he needs to believe that I'm her faithful companion. A month ago it would have been a hard sell, but my time in Summerland has most definitely changed that, and I am willing to pretend to be just about anything in order to win my freedom from this place. Luckily, Catherine has already laid most of the groundwork for me. I dress quickly, the movement tugging the scabs in an uncomfortable but not painful way. The dress fits perfectly, as though it were made for me. The hem is a little shorter than could be considered modest, hitting me just above the tops of my knees, right where I like it to be. What I like to think of as fighting length. There are a pair of loose trousers to go underneath for modesty's sake, and although I don't have all of the weaponry, I'm wearing a very close approximation of an attendant's garb. I pull on my boots and stand, feeling pretty good even though I've been abed the past week. The Duchess purses her lips and hands me the Confederate sword I'd been using. Someone found a scabbard for it, which raises all kinds of questions. "They sent this on over for you as well. The Lady Catherine is waiting for you in the sheriff's office." I nod and take the sword, belting the scabbard around my waist. I feel better having a real weapon, but I still ache for my sickles. Swords are nice and all, but they don't much compare to a pair of well-made short blades. "You have any luck with that medicine I was asking about?" The Duchess shakes her head. "The girl's been suffering through their menses, even though I've been asking. Guess your Miss Catherine is going to have to suffer as well." The meaning behind her words is clear. No laudanum. "I don't suppose there are any opium joints in town. It's a stretch, but I'm thinking that maybe I can lace one of the sheriff's cigarettes with the drug, make him compliant, and then just finish the job." The Duchess purses her lips and shakes her head. "We don't allow any Chinese folks in town. The preacher's made that clear." I sigh. "Well, thank you for your help anyway, Duchess." She nods. "You can repay me by convincing the tinkerer to fix my bath, since you seem to have his ear." I raise my eyebrows in surprise, but say nothing. I lead the saloon through the side entrance my patrol used every morning, brain working through the possibilities. I need to find a way to get out of town once the sheriff is put down, and fast. I get the feeling that the sheriff's men will quickly be able to ascertain what transpired and who the likely culprit is. I have my concerns about making it back to Rose Hill in one piece anyway, but I ain't getting out of town at all if I'm lynched. So outright murdering the sheriff in broad daylight is off the table. More's the pity.
But there's 100 ways a man can end up dead without any kind of real knowing who did it. I'm working through a couple of scenarios. One of them